Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This week we will be discussing Yeshiva World or Kirov, Lakewood or Chabad or Eish HaTorah. From Lakewood, New Jersey, we will have Rabbi Aaron Cutler, scion of the great heritage of Lakewood, New Jersey, Rabbi Schneer Cutler, Rabbi Aaron Cutler, Rabbi Zalman from Crown Heights, New York. We will have Rabbi Simone Jacobson. From Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh, we will have Rabbi Nachum Eisenstein. From Stanford University in California, we will have Rabbi Dov Greenberg, the rabbi of Stanford University. From the worldwide, the famous university lecturer, we will have Rabbi Yitzchak Feldheim, who presented Eish HaTorah on many of the great Ivy League campuses worldwide. This is going to be really a fascinating program. You're listening to us, Matzah Shabbos, 11 to 12 midnight on WMCA 570 AM or on the Nachum Segal Network, Monday morning, 11 AM on NachumSegal.com or Tuesday evening from 7 to 8 PM on WSNR 620 AM. You can find all our shows on www.headlinesbook.com under the audio or podcast section on iTunes. We now have a new hotline you could listen to us. If you're not internet friendly, you can find our shows at 732-806-8700. You can email any questions or comments to info@headlinesbook.com. In the coming weeks, we will be discussing sherry cask whiskey with some of the great machshirim of the world. For those of you who enjoy scotch, we will have some fascinating businessmen and rabbanim discussing the very controversial topics. What happens if you are on national TV or you're at a meeting and you feel that you may not be able to wear your kippah? What is the halacha in such? It's both a halachic and a hashkafic topic, some of the upcoming issues. If you have any issue you would like to discuss, please either call it in to our number or send it in to info@headlinesbook.com. Last week, we spoke about the importance of forgiveness, the Yud Gimel Midas HaRachmim, in life. Because when we forgive and we let go of yesterday, we're practicing resilience, and that means that we can use today fully and move forward in the most powerful possible way. And everybody, be it in business, in relationships, in learning, if we're present, we're so much more effective. Kale means strength. And why is that relevant to forgiveness? Because the stronger I see myself, the easier it is to forgive. If I see myself as a weak person, if I only exist as much as you approve of me, then think of how vulnerable I am. If you approve of me, then I exist. And if you don't, oh my goodness, then I don't. You know, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank was the Rav of Yerushalayim. And he once went to a bar mitzvah. And you know, sometimes Yerushalayim, I don't know if I learned there for many years, they could be a little bit mechutzafim. They could have a little bit of hubris. So he was by a bar mitzvah. And the bar mitzvah boy got up and he gave a speech, a drasha. And the gravamen of his speech was to repudiate an entire shtickle, a thesis that Rav Hirsch Pesach Frank wrote in his sefer. Basically, the rabbi of Yerushalayim is sitting there, and he eviscerates an entire thesis that he wrote in his sefer, in his book, and the rabbi is sitting there, and he's humiliating him in front of him. And he sits there, finishes the speech, and the rabbi nods and leaves. Afterwards, some people come running over, and they say to the rabbi, "How do you respond? He just basically schlugged up your whole speech." And he says, "No, he didn't understand. He didn't understand the Talmud right, didn't understand the Tais right." So they look at him, and he says, "So why didn't you say anything?" So the rabbi looks at the people, and he says, "Why should I say anything? It's not my bar mitzvah." He had such a good sense of self, he couldn't be hurt by the other person. He did not see his existence as a reflection of the other person's opinion. We have to have us. You have a right to your opinion, and I have a right to my opinion, and my sense of myself is strong enough that you can't hurt me. You know, let me tell you this story. There was once a fellow, he was the son of an Indian chief, and he wasn't such a good son. His father was the head chief someplace in Montana, and this son, he was a little bit of a shababnik. And one day, the Indian chief dies, and the son of the Indians, all the Indians come running to him, and they say, new chief, is it going to be a cold winter this year? He didn't know what to say. So he thinks for a minute, he says, I better err to the side of safety. And he says, you know what? It is going to be a cold winter. You better gather wood. So they all go, and they start gathering wood. They come to him, then that night he sneaks into town. He calls up the weather service, and they said, is it going to be a cold winter? The service says, hold on a minute. The guy comes back. He says, yes, it's going to be a cold winter. The next week, the Indians come back to the new chief, and they say, is it going to be a cold winter? They say, he thinks for a minute. He says, I better err to the side. He says, yes, it is. Go gather wood. They go, they gather more wood. That night, he sneaks out again. He calls up the service. He says, is it going to be a cold winter? Very cold winter? They said, yes. He said, okay, good. I gave the right answer. They come back the next week. They said, it's going to be a cold winter. He says, I better err to the side. He said, yes, it's going to be very cold. Gather even more wood. He runs out that night. He calls the service. He says, yes. He says, by the way, how do you know? He says, I'll tell you the truth. The guy from the service says, I never know. But what I do is I check if the Indians are gathering wood. That's how I know if it's going to be. They were basically copying him. He was copying himself. That's what happens. We're copying ourselves. So what's the story here? If you spend your life worried what other people are thinking about you, you're always vulnerable. If you have a strong sense of self, it's much harder to get hurt. So, Kale, feel strong about yourself, and then you won't always be a supplicant for forgiveness. You're listening to us on WMCA, that's 570, or WMCA.com. Or you may be listening to us on the Nachum Segal Network. That's at NachumSegal.com. And we're also on Nachum Segal at 11 a.m. Monday mornings. We are also on WSNR 620 a.m. at 7 p.m. That's drive time, fabulous time, on Tuesday evening. We have the honor of having on the phone with us from Eretz Yisrael, Harav HaGaon Reb Nachum Eisenstein. He's the Rav of Malos Dafna, which is right next to the Mir Yeshiva. He was the Meshamish B'Kodesh by the Rashke Bahag, Rav Yashiv, for around 25 years, who also appointed him as the Av Bezdin of the Geirus Bezdin. Welcome, Harav Nachum.
Hello to all the listeners.
Harav Nachum, we'd like to hear what Rav Yashiv's opinion was on the following Shaila. And the question is, there's a different opinion between Chabad and Olam HaYeshivas, and maybe Yesha Torah or Sameach, etc. And that is that 90% of Acheinu B'nei Yisrael, at least in America, in Eretz Yisrael it's maybe a smaller number, mamish don't know who Moshe Rabbeinu is, who Avraham Avinu was. The Russians, forget about it. For 80 years, they weren't allowed to open a safe with Pikuach Nefesh. Somebody said it's like taking a frozen chicken out of the freezer that's been frozen for 80 years and asking it to fly. So the last Chabadsk Rebbe, the Ramash, the Zecher Tzadik Levracha, wrote, he said if there was a fire burning and there was a Yidin in a house that was burning, would somebody say, you know what, let me go finish my shtickel Torah Cheskes Abatim because there's nothing greater than the Torah? Would anybody do that? He said, Avada not. He said, so how could we stand by when we're watching Acheinu B'nei Yisrael disappear into the Yama of Beina Umais?
Okay, so first of all, everyone has to follow their Rebbe, their Rav, their Rosh Hashiva, to whichever group they belong to. If a person lines himself up with Chabad, he has to follow the Chabad Rebbe. He lines himself up with the Satmar Rebbe, He has to follow the Satmar Rebbe. If he lines himself up with the literacy yeshivas, he has to follow the Das Torah of the daily Rosh Hashivas and Rabbanim in the literacy world. Principally speaking, that we follow the policy of Chayecha Koidmin, that in Ruchniya Solcho there's a halacha of Chayecha Koidmin, and there's a halacha of two people going in the desert, Shtayim Shoyechem Bamidbar, and they only have one jug of water, so questions what to do with the water. If you give it to another person, he'll live and I'll die. We'll split it, we'll both die. If I keep it for myself, I'll die. I'll live and he'll die. And look, it's very clear. Rav Akiva says, the Chayecha Koidmin, we have to do it. A person is the first worry about his own life. This doesn't only apply in Gashmias and actual physical living, but it also applies to Ruchnias, the person's spiritual level. Today, with the what's going on in the world today, that the Nisyanis, the challenges, have never been so much that it's that's what's going on in the street and other places. If we have to protect ourselves from all these dangers, from the day in Deus Christus, there's people exposed today things which were never exposed to be in the past. I'm sure this is well known. I don't have to discuss it. So therefore, the only way to protect ourselves from these evil outside influences is by learning Torah. And a person himself should get a level of Torah that he's Torah's mugging or matzel Torah protects himself. If you take people who they themselves are not fully Oskarba, they're not fully educated in that they have all the necessary tools to fight any outside influence, and therefore they have the koiches, they have the power and the tools to go out and to do cure for other people. So these people, if they feel that they can do it, then there's a concept of giving miser from your time. And Rav Yosef told me clearly when it came out of Takana once that everyone should give 10% from their time for Meiser. Rav Yosef told me clearly, and I remember these were the words back what he says, Bamedvar Mamurim, when it's only referring to when a person has special koiches that he can work in Kiruv. Person has special koichas, where a person's time can go knocking doors and go to places where he himself might have more yurida, more lost than gained from other people of Arikvis, he for sure he doesn't have to go to such places. So that's the general concept. If a person has special talent, he has special talent that he has a koichas to deal with Kiruv, he has to give part of his time to do Kiruv. But that's exactly what Yosef told me. The 10% was talking about people of special talents. Not if you just throw them out in the middle of nowhere, go find people to be Makar. But I want to tell you something. I see many people who were in yeshivas, and they were steiging, and they were having an aliyah ruchnis, and they felt that they have an urge to do kiruv, to save the world. And many of these people who could have grown up to be real elite, what you call B'nai Torah, I see that after they get out in Kiruv, they're involved in Kiruv. But the one who's the Kiruv is done is on them. That the places where they're exposed to, then the car of them, that their levels go down very much. And it's very painstaking to see this, because that we have to be very, very careful that the people that do go to Kiruv, they have to be on a level which they're strong enough. They'll be loy sagur, they're not afraid of anyone, and they shouldn't make any compromises for themselves and especially for their children. I've seen many children who they go to places where it doesn't have the environment and the atmosphere where they're coming from, that what happens to the children is Rahman is not loyal aleinu. So all these things have to be taken into consideration, and the main klal is, one, is the chayecha koidmin, and two is that a person is to give ma'aser from his time only if he's strong enough that he will not have a yerida ruchnis, and that he has special talents, he's giving up his 10% of his time, that he'll be able to be matzliach in an exceptional way.
Reb Nachum, thank you for sharing the das of Rebbe Yashiv and for being, you know, sharing your time with us. We greatly appreciate it. We have with us on the phone from Lakewood, New Jersey, Harab Aaron Cutler, who's the CEO of Lakewood. He's the grandson of Hagoyin Reb Aaron Cutler, the Baal Mishnas Reb Aaron. Welcome, Reb Aaron.
Good morning, David, and good to speak to you again.
So, Rabban, could you tell us what is the Shita of Lakewood about being Osek in Kirov? We know that 90% of Acheinu Beis Yisrael says maybe a 70% intermarriage rate or 65%, someplace in that range. And, you know, let's say in Chabad, they said, this is our raison d'etre. This is the purpose. This is the fire. What is Lakewood's sheet on this?
David, for those who know the history of Lakewood, the great Gedolim who founded it and have a sense of its DNA, they know that a sense of arvus for Klal Yisrael and an absolute active feeling of achrayus run through the very bones and DNA of Lakewood. So when Rav Aaron founded Yeshiva, he saw an American Jewry that was really bereft of any Torah values. And instead of being Isaac in what would be called classic Kirov then, he set a plan, which was to infuse the Jewish people with Torah. That model is not called Kirov by the Kirov moniker or the Kirov name, but is actually maybe something that in some ways is a more powerful force in connecting Yidden to their heritage, keeping them connected to Yiddishkeit, and keeping them, bringing them in for those who are not yet connected, and ensuring the continuity of the Jewish people.
So,
Rav Aaron, I'm sorry, go ahead.
There's no doubt that Rav Aaron has done an amazing job of revitalizing Torah in America. There was nothing here. I mean, there were four yeshivas in America circa 1940, and today there's probably 400. So there's been a 10,000% increase. But on the other hand, if we look at the 65% intermarriage rate and the 80-90% to many, the majority of whom I have an office in Lakewood. So I needed somebody who was non-Jewish to work late on Friday afternoons. So I hired a girl who, with an Italian name, and I was sure. And after a few weeks, my secretary came in. She said, you know, she's Jewish. She married an Italian. So I called her in, and I said, did you ever hear of Abraham? Never heard of him. Isaac? Never heard of him. Jacob?
Wow.
Never. So, and I would say that this is a substantial amount. So Rav Aaron's been incredibly matzliach. There's 400, maybe more, maybe 1,000 yeshivas in America. Intermarriage, 65-70%. They're disappearing. So is it possible that the mission that was then has been super successful, but the other side of it has been a failure, and we have to address that?
Well, David, I agree with your assessment that the other side of it has been a failure, but it's not been a failure just of a yeshiva world or the frum world. It's been a failure in the Kirov world too, and I say that with not only with a love for my fellow Makarvan, but also having spent my first 4 years, instead of going to Kail, teaching at Eish HaTorah, having run my own Kirov organization, so I certainly have some sense of the Kirov world and maintain very close connections with it. And Lakewood itself is very involved in Kira. But I think the real question here is, what is the most effective way to reach the masses of Jews and bring them to Yiddishkeit, keep them in Yiddishkeit, and build their Yiddishkeit? And that's the operative question. The question is not whether we have a chrayus for our fellow Jews. That's a given. The question becomes, what do we do about it? This struggle is a struggle Rav Samson Fall Hirsch faced it, my grandfather in his day faced it, and we face it today. We believe that the optimal Kirov model, and I may surprise you with this, David, is by engaging people in learning. So, for example, it's well known on Campus Kirov, the most effective Campus Kirov program in North America is the one that's run out of the Beis Medrash of Lakewood, where the Campus Makarvim bring secular college kids into the Beis Medrash for either a week of learning, which we do at the end of the year during the holidays. We do it by what's called spring break. and we do it for a 7 or 8 week program in the summer. And David, I think you have met some of these young students who are participating in this. And we find that that's far more effective than, for example, what some of my dear friends are doing in other aspects of Kiruv. I have quite a few friends in Chabad who are doing beautiful work. I have many friends who are on campus itself doing campus Kiruv, and am close. Not only are we close, we fund a variety of Kiruv positions around the country. The most effective way, when I say effective, I'm speaking statistically and practically, of bringing people to Yiddishkeit and keeping them there is by engaging them in learning versus engaging in your traditional, very light learning and Jewish social activities. And the reason for that is that the heart of Yiddishkeit is about Torah, and it's about a Shmiras HaMitzvahs that's driven by learning. We're not known as the people of the book for nothing. So our contribution to the Kiruv world of today is that we're able to infuse it with the Torah learning.
So, Rabbi Aaron, let me ask the following, okay? If we look at Chabad, they have over 5,000, Kiruv
Chabad houses.
Chabad houses, 5,000. And they will tell you that they touch every year more than 50% of all the Yidden in the world. Right? Now, juxtapose that with Lakewood, where they have a summer Kiruv program. There's 5 kollels of around 5 people each in Seattle and other places.
And, no, David.
And I'm just asking you,
Rabbi,
let me finish. And I'm asking you to juxtapose those two shitas and say, we have touched 50%, which is maybe 6 or 7 million Yidden a year on multiple occasions, and one that says it's about learning with everybody, and we probably learn with a few thousand people a year. How would you juxtapose those two?
That's a complete distortion of reality on both sides. And allow me first for a moment on Chabad. Chabad is a Yiddish presence around the world, and they do that in a way that no one else can do. And that their contribution to touching Yidden and making them feel good about being Yidden and connecting them is their specialty. There are over 1,100 Jewish institutions around the world that were founded or are led by alumni of Lakewood. So allow me to give you one example. When you go to Phoenix, Arizona, the Kiruv of Masifta there was founded by Young Light, who came right out of the Lakewood Kollel there. And the same thing is true in just about every city that you go to. The model that you describe of Kollelim has nothing to do about learning with 5 people. It has to do with anchoring Jewish communities and setting them on Torah and bringing Torah into the heart of a Jewish community, into their shuls, into their schools, into their homes. And every Kollel, my dear friend Rabbi Avrami David and his Rebbetzin in Seattle, they touch thousands of lives, but they do more than touch them. They connect them, and they get them, they move them from one of being a passive participant in Yiddishkeit to a deep connection that they'll be able to give on to their children and their grandchildren. We estimate that the average kollel reaches 400 or 500 families on a monthly basis.
And how many kollelim are there? How many Kiruv kollelim are there?
Over what? Well, let's not use the word Kiruv kollelim. How many kollelim are there? Over 100 community kollelim.
So Rabbi Aaron, so it would seem to me that in many respects, you like you say, your friends at Chabad and you, there's not that much of a difference.
There is a difference, and when I say there's a difference, I say this not as a critique on anybody. But I say this as a difference in the model. We aim to produce Talmidei Chachamim who have achrayus for Kollel. We aim to produce Talmidim who have genuine, in-depth Torah knowledge in Lamdas, in Halacha, in Musar, in Hashkafa, and who then go out with achrayus to the world. Some of them will go into business, as you have done. Look at the achrayus you carry. Others go into claw work. Obviously, we think claw work is grossly undermanned. So any Talmud that has even the slightest inclination or interest in claw work, that's something we embrace. We embrace the Balabatim who characterize for claw so in other ways. So the Balabatim of Lakewood who created a Shoimrim type of program or who created a Chaverim type of program, I don't know if you call that care, but if you're taking kids who would be on the street, you give them the ability some chesed, look at what Reb Chaim Abadi is doing. I was just at the Minyan Shabbaton. Do you call that cure?
No. So I'm just saying the difference between you would be then, if you had to put it in two sentences, what would it be?
We aim to produce Talmidei Chachamim who will be lifelong Talmidei Chachamim and who have in their DNA the same achrayus for Klal Yisrael that the Zayd the Rebbaron had and that my father, Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh Livracha, had.
Well, Rebbaron, thank you very much for explaining that so clearly.
Always a pleasure, David, and good to speak to you.
Hello, bye-bye.
We
have the honor of having on the phone with us Harav Reb Simon Jacobson. He's the publisher of the Allgemeine Journal. He's the dean of the Meaningful Life Center. He's the author of many Sfarim. And Achron Chaviv, he was the Chaiser for the Lubavitcher Rebbe Zichrono Livracha. Welcome, Reb Simon.
Thank you very much for having me. My honor and pleasure to be here.
So let me ask you, we had on this morning, we had Reb Aaron Cutler, the CEO of Lakewood, and you know, we asked him, what is the shita of Lakewood towards Reb Aaron, towards Kirov? And I'd like to ask you the same question. When a boy comes to you, he's 19 years old, do you say, go finish Asa Poiskim, or do you say, go to Shlichas? What is the sheet of Chabad in this?
Coming from the school of Chabad, there are a few factors that we take into account. You know, one is the concept of B'nai Yisrael, Arevim Zebazeh. We're responsible for each other, and especially in our times where some people can even classify as Bekuach Nefesh, at least Beruchni is spiritually, the education of our brothers and sisters. So in that context, and you see a fire burning, even from a halachic point of view, you can't just say, listen, I'll be a tzaddik in pelts, which means like a tzaddik in a fur coat, but you have to go out there and do whatever you can to help alleviate the ignorance, the apathy, the prevailing, basically, non-information that so many Jews have. In Chabad, actually, Lubavitcher Rebbe never liked to call it kiruv. He called it more of a responsibility, and achray is simply like trying to reach the souls of Jews who either are tenei kishenishbu and grew up in homes or environments where they did not have the opportunities. And as such, unfortunately, many, many Jews, maybe the majority of the Jewish people today are in that category, so that clearly takes priority. However, I need to classify, just as we know that in the Jewish people we have Yisachar, Zvulun, there are people who are Talmidei Chachamim, people who are Balei Esek. So in this case as well, case by case, there are definitely individuals. I know, for example, some Bochrim, they were 19 years old, they went into the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and the Rebbe said to them, your job is to go into yeshiva, to be an hola, because their kashrenes, their skills and their talents were fitting far more to be in yeshiva, either to be an hola or... Some people, more rarely, the minority, that would spend a life more in the world of Torah and learning and so on. But the majority, definitely, especially in our day and age, were encouraged to go out and in some way help our brethren and grow in their Yiddishkeit, or for that matter, just become aware of even what it means to be a Yid.
And how would you respond to, let's say, we had Rabbi Nachum Eisenstein, who says, you know, there's a klal always chayecha koidman. And he says that when you have a choice to, you know, steigen learning, become a big Talmud Chacham, become fresh, you know, proficient, bavli, rishal, you can't do this when you're 19. He says, chayecha koidman, a person should not give up their ruchnias for somebody else. He says, shnayim shaholchu b'midbar v'yesh b'm kita nechad shalmayim. How would you respond to that?
That is maybe in conventional times. You know, in conventional times, for example, you go in Zman HaShas, or even later, when the Jews lived in Shtetlach, there were far different challenges and opportunities. But let's just go back to one, I think, important klal here. if Jews are really one organism, in the words of the Yerushalmi, that Avos Yisrael is based on the fact that we're one body, and just like one, there's a right arm, there's a left arm, and therefore the Kema Achas Shleim Akul Klal Yisrael is hurting because so many people don't have education. One could argue that due to the, whether you call it Pekuach Nefesh, physically or spiritually, you're dealing with a situation where there's a fire burning. I don't think any halacha, any pesach would say that if I see a burning fire and I see children or adults in that building, say Chayecha Kedmin and go to your base medrash and learn. Obviously, you can't put yourself in sakana in the sense of running into a building where you can get hurt. You need to be in a position of strength. But to completely ignore it and make believe it doesn't exist. So I think the achrayis that we have to each other, if it was your own brother and sister, biological brother and sister, do we also say Chayecha Kedmin and we ignore their plight?
Simon, what about the concept of if you send somebody out when they're young, they are going to, on some level, going to be foregoing on a certain Havana in Limud HaTorah. I mean, it's because they don't usually go out for an hour or two. It's much more extended. So in effect, they're giving up like a certain steiging that they would otherwise do. And I'm just repeating, I'm not taking a position. I'm just repeating what Rav Nachum Eisenstein said.
So excellent. I appreciate it. It's good to listen. We're here to hammer out the idea in a way that creates a libun hilchus, so to speak, a clarity, a crystallizing. So I fully understand.
We have a Kabbalah Avram Yitzchak and Yankif. We have thesis, antithesis, synthesis.
There you go.
Right.
Excellent. Excellent. And that's how you get to it. There's Vav Vesufa, but the way you go through is Pulpula Talmidim, and we have to so-called argue out the point. Okay, the response is as follows. It comes down to this. Is, you know, there's a famous story with the Ragachover Gaon, Rabbi Yosef Rosen. So he was asked to join the Vad, where was it, whatever city he was in at the time. And he said he can't join the Vad, which was really for Askonis Tziburis. Why? Because he can't go and resolve an argument between a Bavli and a Rishalmi. What was he referring to? You know, in his Gaonis, he was referring to whether Esek B'tzarchi Tzibur, so in the Bavli it says, Teirosei Mishtameres, and in Rishalmi it says, Teirosei Mizbareches. So, Mishtameres means if you go into and you Esek B'tzarchi Tzibur, your Teira will be preserved, but it won't necessarily grow as if you were learning. So it'll stay status quo, so to speak. Whereas according to the Yerushalmi, Tairosim is Bareches, meaning because you're Oisek B'tzach Yitzibur, and the famous expression, through Tzedakah Nase Mechi V'Liboy Zakim Elef Pomim Kacha, so in a sense, the Eibishter blesses your Teda, that, for example, that would take another person 10 hours, you could figure it out in 1 hour. Like Rabun, the famous Gemara Rabun, and also Yerushalmi, that he was able to achieve in a shorter span of time what others can do in a longer span. So the Agachover didn't want to get into that argument, so he said that's why he's declining.
Rabbi Eisenstein had another point. He says, unfortunately, we see a lot of times where yeshivalite go to college campuses for kirov purposes, and they find that they put their own ruchnius besakana. How do you weigh the importance of kirov vis-a-vis your own ruchnius?
You see, here we're getting into something which I think is very, very, a very critical conversation. Coming from so-called a Chabad persuasion, obviously I was educated a certain way to think about this. But I think about it a lot because I say sometimes to myself, you know, how do you speak to a person, let's say, whose Rebbe or teacher advised otherwise? Let me just for a moment present the so-called Chabad approach, if I could call it that. Even though I think it's more than just a Chabad approach, I think it's based on a universal Torah outlook, it comes down to this. We live in a world where just sitting insulated in any shtetl is not necessarily the guarantee for not being affected by modern world. We're no longer 300-400 years ago. We see today the crisis of the internet that some call a mobile phone. I mean, it's almost unlikely that an adult doesn't have a mobile phone. I mean, there are exceptions, of course. So you're dealing with the walls of the ghetto are no longer physically possible to keep out the influences. So to suggest that someone's going to sit in Kail and learn and say that alone is a preservation and protection from everything that's going on outside, lav dafka. I'm not here, you know, obviously we don't want to talk negatively. We only talk about Shchus and Shal Yisrael. We've got plenty of problems behind the closed doors of yeshiva and kollel. The income amokim lahirik.
Yeah, but you can't compare. You just can't compare a modern college campus to the worst yeshiva. It's just not. It's still a nedaima, right?
Okay. No, of course. I didn't finish my. That was a comma, not a period. Okay. So my second half of the sentence would be the second thing, which is this. Essentially, the education I was educated in is that the best defense is offense. Like, let's use the Lashon and the Hilchos Kashrus. I did the Torah Lemivla Leipolit. I did the Torah Lepolit Lemivla. If you're busy exuding and teaching and being mashpia, influencing, you're less prone to be that vulnerable and be too receptive of negative influences. So with that attitude, dealing taku with the challenges of our time, what does that mean? If you go in a position where you are a teacher, an educator, a mashpia, whatever term we use for it, again, we all know that there's no magic pill. But it tends to create an environment and at least a form of a certain immunity because you're being influenced. As opposed to just, let's say, hiding behind closed doors, it may not be as effective.
So let me extend the question from Rabbi Eisenstein. He said, what happens to the children of the shluchim? They go to where there's no the yeshiva education, and they're ready. They're not being mashpias. He says, you're being misakin the mishpacha. What has the experience been in that respect?
There are challenges, and I personally have relatives and quite a number of relatives and friends. The challenges, of course, begin in some cities. They don't even have a yeshiva yet. So you have to send your children away, or you have to create your own system. I think it's important, and I just want to make sure we don't get into this type of, I don't want to call it a spitting contest. I don't know.
On this program, we try very, very hard to stay away from negativity. And
right.
I ask this question with curiosity rather than Chas v'Shalom trying to point the finger. It's curious.
No, I accept that. I mean to say, like, if I was an objective researcher, it would be interesting statistically to see the children, let's say, of those Chabad shluchim that have gone out, what has been the so-called fallout rate, and look at the children of people who have not gone out and have remained behind the walls of, let's say, Torah and Yerushalayim and so on.
That's the question here. If you lived in Borough Park, Flatbush, Lakewood, Bnei Brak your whole life, or you were the child of a shliach or the child of any of the above, statistically, how do you do?
I've never done this research. I would say it's not necessarily. I'd probably say I would vote more that the shlichus department probably does better. However, with one important qualification, I think there's a case-by-case element to this, because I think whether it's growing up in Broad Park, Lakewood, or Williamsburg, or going out on, let's say, the Chabad approach of going out on shlichus, I think it comes down to what the parents provide. I mean, I've seen my own experiences. I've seen there people, healthy environments that have a healthy form of attitude to Yerushalayim and Yiddishkeit and Torah mitzvahs, generally produce healthier children. And if it's not a healthy home, whether you're a shliach or you're living in Lakewood, I don't know if that alone is going to save your life. So I think that you have to add into the equation not just the type of lifestyle they've chosen, but also what kind of parents we're dealing with. And I think that's a critical component here that's maybe less spoken of. In other words, you can have healthy people, unhealthy people, even if they do everything right with all the Torah mitzvahs and Yerushalayim, they just will produce children that are dysfunctional, unfortunately, who will not embrace and continue to perpetuate what they were brought up with. And I cannot say that every Chabad shliach is the healthiest person either, so therefore that can be a factor as well. So in other words, I'm just adding a variable that's not really connected to the discussion we're having.
Reb Simon, would it be fair to take away a maskana from this conversation, is that the shita of Chabad, of sending almost 5,000 shluchim around the world, is a gedder of a hiruas shah, of a pikuach nefesh, because of a burning house. And, when it comes a time, mayim al yam al yam achasim, and moli aretz deya, actually, there may not be that much of a difference in the shitas?
It's a very good question. I never thought of it that way. I appreciate the question. I'm thinking about it. I think there's two sides to it. I think there is one aspect of it is correct, that when you're dealing with so many Jews that simply need someone to reach to them. You have a Hirasha element. But there's another side, which is the Mishpacha Achaz that we are. You know, thinking about the Malar Zdeyas Hashem, let's say the model of the Beis HaMikdash model, when all Eden were either around Yerushalayim, Eretz Yisrael, or when Mashiach comes. So we have Lo Yilamdu Eid Isha Sre'eyu, Ki Kulam Yeidi Oisi. So you have the concept of less needs to help each other because of Pekoach Nefesh, so to speak, and rather it would be more of a camaraderie like Chavrusa learning. You know, in that case, you'd have all the Eden essentially interested in learning Torah, so I think we would all be like one big base medrash. It's really, as you quoted the Pasuk, Mala Arz Deyas Hashem, it simply means the entire earth will be like one big yeshiva. So, of course, you won't have the same need for that. But then there may be another need, maybe a need of a greater teacher giving some of his time to students and to people who are not on his level. The Talmidei Yesir Mekulam element, you know, that our students give us more than we give them. But I think that's how I would respond to your question.
Well, thank you very much, Reb Simon. That was very enlightening. And it was an honor to have you on. And thank you very much for participating.
Thank you. Thank you for your pointed questions. It brings out the best.
Take care, Colton. Bye-bye.
Be well. Bye.
We have on the phone with us Rabbi Yitzhak Feldheim, who's Rav of Yardley, Pennsylvania for 15 years, and who's also Eish HaTorah's preeminent lecturer on the college circuit, going through most of the, or many of the great colleges in this country, and has a first-hand, boots-on-the-ground knowledge of what's going on at the campuses. Welcome, Reb Yitzhak.
Shalom Aleichem, Reb David. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
So, Reb Yitzhak, could you tell us, data-wise, what has been your experience? Is there truly, to quote Bernie Lander, a Holocaust going on there among Jewish youth?
100% is a Holocaust. I would just qualify it. I don't think it's just a Holocaust of Jewish youth. I think the entire culture of the youth in America today, probably the entire world. My experience is primarily America. But the world is living in Yiddish. Everyone's running away from existence. It used to be you went to college and you talked to kids about ideas and philosophy, and today you get a blank look on their faces. It's like, Rabbi, I'm spending $30,000 a year tuition, and I get drunk every night. You think my problem is I don't know what I should be doing? My problem is that I don't do the stuff I already know I should be doing. You're going to tell me more stuff to do? I'll just put it in the back of the line. When I get around to the stuff that I know I should be doing, then I'll do your stuff. The world gave up, and anything that's meaningful or significant or that deals with their higher aspirations, those are the things that they're running away from. It's not just that they're apathetic. They're hiding from it. I would say that there's a mile to that, and the idea that you don't hide from something unless it scares you. And if it scares you, it means that they're still hearing that. They still know those dreams and those values. They just don't believe that they have a place in them. What is Judaism and what is the outside world to define assimilation? What is the loss of what we have? So I think what we have is this, is a life of joy, of happiness. And if you define Yiddishkeit as dreams, as all those values that we aspire to, justice, love, meaning, purpose, truth, so everyone's assimilating. Where do kids go at night? Everyone's in clubs. You don't go to clubs to experience joy, to experience meaning. You go to clubs because every year they get darker and louder. They're a place to hide from everything you ever wanted. If Judaism represents the dream, then virtually everyone is hiding. Listen, a girl in the secular world today, a Jewish girl, goes to college. She has basically two options. When she was 10 years old, she wanted to marry a guy who was going to love her forever, honor her, care about her, be dedicated to her, and care about and want no one else but her. A girl today in college, a Jewish girl goes there. She has, probably mostly a dormitory college. You know, the colleges the kids aspire to go to. The chances in the city when you stay home and live at home are a little better. But the general experience is Jewish kids want to go out of town. So a girl goes out of town, that girl. She has two options. One option is give up on all her dreams. She'll never find a guy who's going to put a ring on her finger and pledge undying love without being with 30 other girls first. That doesn't exist in college. The best Jewish boys are that's gone. They don't believe that they're capable of that kind of loyalty and commitment. And everybody is playing around first. So option number one is she gives up all her dreams. Option number two is she holds on to her dreams and she never gets married because it doesn't exist.
Let's talk about intermarriage assimilation. What has been your experience? What have you seen with the Jewish kids on campus?
Again, I don't know how it plays out, who actually marries Jews. The question is, who's marrying Jewish? Who's marrying from their best self? Who's dating from their best self? If a Jew happens to coincidentally marry another Jew because he's hanging around with other Jews, so yeah, maybe you bought yourself technically, genetically, another generation. But if you define intermarriage as a person who comes from a world of aspirations and dreams and meaning and purpose, marrying out of that, so everyone's intermarrying. Everyone's marriage today, people define a happy marriage even like when people they don't fight. You know, we have our own little worlds. We've redefined everything. The whole intermarriage question I don't think it's as significant as people make it out to be, because not for a good reason, for a bad reason, that the war is lost before intermarriage. If a Jew goes to a college with a lot of Jewish kids, so the girl he meets in the club or the girl who he's going to marry because he doesn't think that she's so holy, so he doesn't think he's going to have to, you know, get up for Shacharis and learn. And not that the second kids are doing that, but he's finding a girl who doesn't bring out the best in him, he doesn't feel pressured by. When a guy marries a girl like that, that's called intermarriage in my mind. Now, he may happen to bump into a Jewish girl because 25% of the girls in his campus are Jews, so there's a 25% chance, and maybe a little higher because he does prefer a Jewish girl to keep his family sort of happy. But in the larger picture, we're losing our kids. We don't lose our kids when their genes change. We lose our kids when their dreams change.
Do you think that do you think yeshiva boys are cut out and they can do kiruv?
I think that the only person who can really do kiruv is a guy who lives in the Olay Shel Torah. That was the relationship supposed to be of Yaakov and Esau. It was supposed to be Shnei Geim. They had to be Shutfim. You can't separate the Ish Sada, the communicator, the guy who's going to deal with the world, from the Yoshvei Oyel. It's part and parcel, because if what we're selling is belief in the world, in yourself, in possibility, then you have to have that fire in your eyes. The person who's most qualified to do kiruv, if he had the communication skills, he needs to learn that. But the person who's most qualified, or really the only person who's qualified, is the guy who's sitting and learning, and he comes out with confidence in his holiness, in his goodness, in his discipline, and the fire in his eyes. When you send that guy out to campus, and he walks onto campus, everyone sees the difference. They see who they were when they still had dreams. And that's all they need. That guy can clean up.
Well, Rabbi Yitzchak, thank you very much. We have on the phone with us from California the Rav of Stanford University, rated as the most difficult university in the United States to get into. It surpassed Harvard University. It gets the highest caliber of students. Rabbi Dov Greenberg. Welcome, Rabbi Greenberg.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on with you.
So, Rabbi Greenberg, we had the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zichron Levracha, said in a letter, he said, the greatest challenge to our generation, he said, it's the disappearance of the 80% of Klal Yisrael that is secular. He compared it to a house that's on fire. And he said, would somebody, if your house was on fire, he said, would you take a Shulchan Aruch or a Gemara and go learn? Or would you run into the house to try to save the people? So, you're somebody at ground zero of where it's occurring. Could you share your experience? What is it like
for the Jewish students at Stanford University? What is the level of assimilation? Can we make a difference? What's happening there? Give us the frontline experience.
Sure. So I would say a very good way to understand literally what goes on across college campuses at Stanford, but really across the Western world in America, is you have, for example, at the Seder, we have the Arba Bonim. So somebody, I think it was the Belzer Rebbe, once said that the four children at the Seder reflect also four generations of the Jews that came to America. You have the initial generation, who was the tzaddik, the immigrants who still kept Torah and mitzvahs very strongly in their hearts and in their homes and in their lives. So that's one generation. We're very familiar with that generation. Then you had a generation, often in America and sometimes even before, a second generation, the second child. In other words, the children in terms of a generational line. The second generation rebelled. They said, forget Torah, forget mitzvahs. We don't want it. We want out. So that was the rebellious generation. You come to a third generation in America, which now is also very prevalent. A confused generation. They don't know because they're confused. They had grandparents that did one thing and parents that did another. So what does it mean to be a Jew? But it was a confused generation. The fourth generation is already she'inu yodea lishul. They don't even know how to ask a Jewish question because it's so far from their life. They didn't experience it. On college campuses, what we have right now, and you said 80%, but it's even more. Every college campus is like loaded with the fifth generation students. In other words, you have kids that are so far removed. They're barely coming to the Seder. They're barely coming to Shabbos. So that's the vast majority. You have to picture it. Imagine you would have a Seder in this generational thing, and you're dealing with a generation that's so alienated. Now, in you have, for example, an economic policy. It's a theory of wealth that inherited wealth lasts a few generations, three generations, four, but not more. And Yiddishkeit is very similar. You could go for a few generations without teaching and without proper chinuch, and often it will still survive. It will still be there somehow. But now we're dealing at a time. We're living through a time where in this generation, if we don't reach out and save those Jews, then we are losing the 80%. Maybe not all the 80%, but we're going to lose the vast majority. So it's like a house burning, but we're at a critical burn here. And the thing that is important for people, from Jews to recognize is that, again, the majority of the Jews today, the majority of students on campus, they didn't rebel against Yiddishkeit. They don't have bad feelings against Yiddishkeit. They're not saying, we don't want Shabbos, we don't want Torah, we don't want to learn good. They don't know what it is. They never saw it. It's a fourth generation, a fifth generation. They simply don't know the beauty of Shabbos, the beauty of learning a piece of Gemara, and the values of Yiddishkeit. So when we reach out and literally invite them in or touch a Jewish person, it's matzel nefesh. It changes their life because it opens the doors of our rich of Yiddishkeit and our rich tradition. So in a way, it's very easy to make an incredible difference, and I think that's what we're all called on to do, and everybody can play a very strong role in this.
So Rabbi Greenberg, in my experience, and it's somewhat limited, the vast majority of Americans are not very interested in religion. They're very happy with their 500 channels of TV, with their, they live a very affluent, a very happy lifestyle. There's a certain vacuous, you know, it's Vayishman Yishur and Vayivat. They have no reason to search. As a rule, they're in the top 4 or 5% of affluence. They're very successful. Almost stereotypically, you know, Hollywood-like successful. It's like, you know, almost humorously. And there's very little driving them to search. And you reach out to them, you invite them to a Shabbos or this, and they come and they eat gefilte fish and latkes, and they make a few barsh belt jokes, and they look serious, and then it sort of just disappears. Do you find it possible to make a more, you know, more than a skin-deep impression on them?
Look, my great-grandfather actually came from the shtetl, like many Jews in America. He dropped his tefillin into the Atlantic on his way over. He went through a difficult time in the early 1900s, so he came, and he left Yiddishkeit. His children grew up in America. They also grew up in a secular way. That's my great grandfather and my grandparents. My father and mother, in the late 1960s, 1970, they actually were they were the secular students that you just described, from affluent families, and they were not engaged Jewishly in any way, because it was already two generations that they had no Yiddishkeit in their family, really. They had, my father, the only thing he had was a Pesach Seder Kiviyachol that had a bread option, a bread basket also, but that was their Yiddishkeit. They encountered a shliach then on campus, Rabbi Gordon, and slowly they started to learn. They went to Shabbos. They started to learn. They became frum. So, and they had children. Right now, tonight, in a few hours. Now it's Friday. In a few hours, I'm one of their children. We're going to have about 100 students. I have three other siblings. I have a sibling at Emory University, who's a shliach there, sister.
That's in Atlanta.
At Lehigh in Pennsylvania and Muhlenberg College. The Chabad house at Emory is going to have about 150 students tonight. We're going to have about 80 students. Lehigh will have close to 100, Muhlenberg 70. So you have from one Jew walking on a campus and decided to learn with a secular Jew who you can look at and say, Vayishman Yisrael and Vayivot, you know, they're not interested. But when you touch the heart of a Jew, when you touch a Jew, it's Balvais Einish HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's a child of Hashem. So you could say that the Jew is secular and not interested, or you could realize that with one daf of a Gemara, with one mitzvah, you could change their heart and you could have a Heshev Lev of Yisrael Bonim. You could bring a Jewish child back home.
And now there's 500 people sitting by Shabbos.
And now you have, and it's not an extraordinary story, because the story happens thousands of times. It happens thousands of times in any community. It happens thousands of times, certainly in the Chabad community, but it happens in any community. It's not a Chabad thing. We're talking about to be matzal nefesh b'Yisrael has nothing to do with Chabad. It has to do with what it goes to the heart of the essence of what it is to be a Yid, to care for another Yid. So in any community, in any home, or any business person, any frum yid, who says, you know, I am learning and I'm raising a family and that's beautiful, but when I go to business, I also care about another Jew, or whoever it is, whatever role one plays, but to say that I also have a concern for Jews that are not exactly frum, when we reach out and touch them, it is impossible to calibrate and calculate the ripple effect that has. The only thing we do know is that every yid is a elam mole, and when we do what we could do, we will save the Jewish people.
Well, thank you very much, Rabbi Greenberg, and keep up your incredible work.
Thank you.
Cult of all the best. Bye-bye. This is David Lichtenstein, Headlines Radio. I look forward to speaking to you.